Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, September 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, tensions remain high as investigations continue into who is responsible for an attack on a huge Saudi oil facility.
I don't want war with anybody, but we're prepared more than anybody.
Uganda's efforts to control an Ebola outbreak are seeing success. And a young singer's latest single empowers women to love themselves just the way they are. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump said Monday that it looked like Iran was behind attacks on oil plants in Saudi Arabia, but he did stress that he didn't want to go to war, as the attacks sent oil prices soaring and raised fears of a new Middle East conflict.
I'm not looking to get into new conflict, but sometimes you have to.
Iran has rejected U.S. charges. It was behind the strike Saturday that damaged the world's biggest crude processing plant and triggered the largest jump in crude prices in decades. Several U.S. cabinet members, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Energy Secretary Rick Perry, have blamed Tehran for the strikes.
Make no mistake about it. This was a deliberate attack on the global economy and the global energy market.
Relations between the United States and Iran have deteriorated since Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear accord last year and reimposed sanctions over Tehran's nuclear and ballistic programs. Joining us to talk more about the situation is Dr. Jesse Moritz, lecturer at the Australian National University's Center for Arab and Islamic Studies. Thank you so much for being with us. These attacks and their implications seem like they're a very big deal. Would you agree with that?
There's a couple of reasons why this is a big deal. One is Saudi Arabia, so it's one of the largest producers of oil. It's also quite important because Saudi Arabia is responsible for much of the world's rare production capacity. So what this means is that Saudi Arabia will often step in when there is some type of oil price shock, but obviously at the moment they can't do that. The oil price shock is domestic. It's happening in their territory. So in part, that's another reason why the Saudi case is so important. In terms of where the strikes happened, you're talking about the Abqaiq or Bukhaiq oil processing facility. The Saudis claim it's the world's largest oil processing facility. So it is responsible for about 7% of daily global oil production, or about 7 million barrels per day. And so that you have a sense of what Abqaiq does, they process oil by converting what's called sour crude oil to sweet crude oil by removing sulfur. So that's a key step before that sweet crude is exported or used for other things. So one of the reasons why this is so important is because of Abqaiq and its role in the global oil industry, as well as Saudi Arabia's broader role in the global oil industry.
Apparently, we're already seeing the impact in global oil prices.
We are. When trading started, the Brent crude price jumped about 19, almost 20% to over $70 per barrel. West Texas Intermediate, another crude type, also jumped about 15% at start of trading. And the latest figures that I've got is as of about 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Brent crude was up 14.6%, and it was about $69 per barrel. That may have changed further since or when this goes to air. But yeah, significant impact. And then that has flow-on impact onto other markets. So that's going to affect, for example, the airline industry over time. It's already having a global impact around the world.
What do you know about the Saudi relationship with the Houthi rebels in Yemen? Because we know that this has just been this ongoing, really humanitarian disaster over there. But the U.S. is insisting that this was not the Houthis, it was Iran. Could we get a clue at all by what we know about Saudi-Houthi relations?
They're somewhere between sort of a tribal group. They're an ethnic identity. They're also a Shia group that lives mostly in the mountainous northern regions of Yemen. They've been there for a very long time. They have a nationalist identity. They are Yemeni. They're not necessarily a natural proxy for Iran. Houthis largely ascribe to what's called Fiver or Zaydi Shiism, and the Iranians and most Shia in the world subscribe to what's called Twelver or Issa Sharia Shiism. So There's some religious practices that are a little different, and there's a nationalist identity that's important to remember when it comes to the Houthis. There were some domestic reasons in terms of the Houthi-Yemeni state relationship that were part of the cause for the civil war in Yemen. However, at the same time, the Iranians were quite interested in supporting the Houthis, and they made occasional statements about supporting the Houthis. They tended to deny sort of direct military support, but they would nonetheless talk about, you know, their brothers and how important this was to challenge autocracy, etc. So back in 2011, 2012, you're talking about, you know, largely a domestic issue with sort of rhetorical support from Iran and possibly some pragmatic acceptance of aid by the Houthis. As the conflict intensified, that relationship became a little bit stronger. And in my analysis, is that, again, this was largely due to pragmatic acceptance of Iranian help rather than some sort of natural sort of alignment between goals and ideologies between the Houthis and the Iranians. So over time, there's been some evidence that Iranians have provided military support to the Houthis. That's why there's discussion about, you know, these were Iranian weapons that were involved in the strike, but were they fired from Iran or were they fired from Yemen or from some other Iran-backed group in the Middle East?
We know Saudi Arabia and Iran have been enemies for decades, and of course Iran is very angry by sanctions imposed by Saudi ally, the United States. But Iran's president said the strikes were definitely carried out by the Yemeni people retaliating for attacks on the Saudi-led military coalition in this war with the Houthi movement. Would you say that that would be a relatively believable reason for the Houthis to do this, and do they have the capability?
This relationship between the Iranians and the Houthis is perceived very differently by Iran, and probably by the Houthis themselves, and by Saudi Arabia and Western, some Western actors as well. So Saudi Arabia claims the Houthis and Iran are basically the same thing. They don't draw a distinction between them. I've interviewed some former members of government in Saudi Arabia, and I asked them, do you see a distinction between, you know, Houthis and Iran? And they said, no, it's that they're the same thing. They're all Iran. Whether in terms of do the Houthis have the capability to pull off this type of attack, well, of course, we've seen some of the satellite images showing that the strikes on Abqaiq, I think about 19 impact points, came from the sort of northwest direction, and there's some suggestion that that may have been difficult for the drone sent from Yemeni territory to a strike from that direction. I think that's being investigated at the moment. So both the U.S. administration has announced that they're looking into that and that they'll make an announcement once they have clarity on where the weapons were fired from and who exactly is responsible. The Saudis as well have announced that they would like to invite international experts, including from the UN, to investigate, which create some space for them to decide how they want to respond, because of course there is a potential for military confrontation here. So I think they're trying to be relatively careful.
All right, that is Dr. Jessie Moritz. She's a lecturer at the Australian National University Center for Arab and Islamic Studies. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Islamic State's reclusive leader issues a new call for action. American farmers hope for a U.S.-China trade deal as pork and soybean tariffs start to ease. New York prosecutors are seeking 8 years of President Trump's tax returns. And a Chinese-American couple have been charged with theft of trade secrets from an Ohio hospital. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services Alex Azar has applauded Uganda's efforts to control the spread of Ebola in East and Central Africa. However, while the U.S. remains the primary funder of Uganda's healthcare sector, the secretary did not shy away from asking the East African country to find funds to independently sustain its healthcare budget. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Since June, Uganda has identified and isolated 4 Ebola victims who entered the country from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The monitoring has prevented the Ebola epidemic, which has killed nearly 2,000 people in eastern Congo, from crossing the border. U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services Alex Azar is leading a U.S. delegation to Rwanda, the DRC, and now Uganda regarding Ebola.
There is immense work that has had to be done in bolstering preparedness and response capacities, screening those crossing the border, and responding to the discovery of cases. Uganda, particularly the Ministry of Health and Minister Acheng, have risen to the occasion, providing a model for the region.
The U.S. is a major financier of Uganda's health sector, helping to combat AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, Ebola, and improve maternal and child health care. In fiscal year 2018, the U.S. provided more than $511 million in healthcare funding. Secretary Azar encouraged Uganda to be more self-sustaining.
And we have seen tremendous achievements in Uganda in terms of the building up of the public health system and healthcare infrastructure as a result of that partnership. Now, of course, over time, that needs to be more self-sustained. And that does require that Uganda invest its own resources also in the healthcare system.
Ambassador Deborah Malak expressed confidence Uganda is capable of meeting its own healthcare needs.
But one cannot expect that the U.S. government will be the donor of choice in this area, you know, an open-ended future. So it really is about building capacity and ultimately putting ourselves out of the assistance business.
On Sunday, there were reports from Tanzania that a doctor who was studying in Uganda had died of a viral infection akin to Ebola. The Tanzanian ministry quickly came out and denied the allegations, calling them rumors. Yonast again Waldemariam, the World Health Organization representative in Uganda, expressed concern about the situation.
This mysterious disease has to be investigated and samples have to be tested. We couldn't rule out any of the viral hemorrhagic fevers, and the investigation will continue. And we look forward of the Tanzanian government collaborating as per the international health regulations to address this issue.
Countries near Congo continue to be on high alert for any new cases of Ebola, with strict adherence to control guidelines set by the WHO. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Britain's Boris Johnson said Monday that a Brexit deal was beginning to emerge, but the EU said he offered nothing to break the impasse during a visit to Luxembourg, where he was shouted out by protesters. Anna Bevan reports.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson received a frosty reception in Luxembourg on Monday as he arrived for talks with his counterpart Xavier Bettel. Protesters gathered outside the Luxembourg Prime Minister's office, holding anti-Brexit signs and chanting anti-Brexit slogans. Such was the noise that Johnson then cancelled a joint press conference, leaving Bettel to speak to reporters beside an empty podium. The future of the land border between EU member Ireland and the British province of Northern Ireland is the central issue of disagreement, both between Johnson and the EU and between Johnson and British lawmakers. Britain is due to leave the EU in less than 7 weeks.
That's Anna Bevan reporting. President Trump will travel to Houston, Texas on Sunday to take part with India's prime minister in an event called Howdy Modi. With over 50,000 free tickets already distributed, the event promises to be the largest such event ever held in the United States for a visiting head of state. VOA Asia's Ira Melman was in Houston last week and spoke with Jugal Molani, the executive director of the event. Before the announcement that the U.S. president would be attending, he started by asking why it is called Howdy Modi.
Well, it named Howdy Modi because, you know, we were just sitting, you know, few of us in a room and discussing what should it name. Someone coined the phrase Howdy Modi and everyone liked it. Just so it became Howdy Modi. It's a slang in Texas. How do you do, Modi? So, you know, I think we all liked it, so we just kept it Howdy Modi.
Who is coming? How many people are coming to view it?
The venue is Energy Stadium. It is one of the largest stadium in Houston, which can hold more than 50,000 people. And so I think when we started registering people, the stadium, we have a full crowd. So more than 50,000 people are going to attend this event. And of course, everyone is going to listen to Prime Minister Modi. That is his charisma, which is bringing all the Indian diaspora on one platform.
And what's the purpose of this?
This is to strengthen our US Indo-American ties. You know, this is a event which we think once we do it, you know, it will carry forward how the relationship between US and India may be in a different level. And also it is kind of a celebration of Indian diaspora. You know, it's such a big event, all the Indian diaspora coming on one platform. So it's kind of a celebration of Indians in Houston. You know, Houston is the fourth largest city in US, and the population of Indians is about 150,000 people, you know, and Indians are in all different areas, including doctors, engineers, business people, CEOs of the companies. So you name it, I think Indians have really flourished in Houston.
Tell me the story, if you could, about you came up with this idea. How did you get in touch and convince the Prime Minister of India to come to Houston before he heads to the UNGA?
Well, when we came to know that he's coming to US for this UNGA meeting, I think the invitations went from different cities, and they narrowed it down to like three cities, Houston, Boston, and Chicago. And, you know, like we all wrote, all the organizations here wrote him a letter inviting him here. So we exactly don't know how the decision was made, but we are happy that he's coming to Houston.
And what do you hope to get out of this?
You know, strengthen the relationship. And, you know, as I said, this is take to a, you know, different level, you know, understand. I think once he visits here, you know, there are a lot of oil and gas industries and other things. Hopefully, you know, something will better will come out of all these things, the meetings.
What is it about Prime Minister Modi that makes him so attractive to so many people? I heard him described as a rock star.
He is a rock star for sure. You know, he is very popular in India as and also all over the world because he comes from a very, from a very normal, humble beginnings. And he can understand the people's who are less fortunate or underprivileged, what are the requirements. So he has done a lot of things in India to improve their lifestyle, you know, and he has given like in a lot of villages there were no toilets. So there were millions of toilets were built. Then he gave, there were, cooking gas was given to free. So a lot of these things have made him very popular by providing the simple benefits to the poor people or underprivileged people.
I have seen there are going to be protests. You know, any political leader, especially of such a huge country, is going to have people against what he is doing. Are you prepared for that?
You know, it's a democratic country. Everyone has right to protest as long as peaceful, you know, so they can express their voice. And, you know, and I'm sure, you know, it will be there. So I don't think it is our problem. We are going to concentrate on our event. We are all very excited. Our team is working very hard to deliver a flawless event.
All right, that's VOA Asia's Ira Melman. He was speaking with Jugal Malani, executive director of the upcoming event, Howdy Modi. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
Thank you.
VOA's International Edition continues. A Danish ship owner's efforts to fight piracy and severe droughts that killed most of Somaliland's livestock in 2017 have resulted in a thriving fishing industry, a sustainable and completely new food supply. I talked about it with reporter Amy Gutman, who just got back from Somaliland, where she learned about this nomadic culture suffering from the impacts of climate change and drought that basically reinvented itself.
Somaliland is typically a nomadic culture. That means that they're pastoral nomads. So they feed their families and they earn a living by keeping animals, mostly camels and goats and sheep. Except a combination of things have really threatened this way of life. And it's mostly been severe, extreme, and all too frequent droughts, culminating in the 2017 drought, which killed almost all of the country's livestock. Now, interestingly, another event was in the works leading up to 2017 that has helped propel the country into an entirely new industry. So just as these droughts were really starting to increase in regularity, so from about 2013, just a few years before then, a Danish ship owner whose ship and crew had been hijacked by Somali pirates, so not Somalilander pirates, but Somali pirates, had actually negotiated the release of his crew, and that was back in 2009. So if you fast forward 2 years, his crew was safe, everything was fine, and he decided to do something about this. He decided that he wanted to tackle the problem at the root, and obviously this meant helping people with more opportunities for better livelihoods and more ways of earning a sustainable income, and at the same point, creating a new sustainable food supply and source of food. So he decided that he would start in Somaliland because it's more safe than Somalia and it's a peaceful democracy. And so he started there by teaching a man to fish, literally. Fishing is not a part of the culture of Somaliland, unlike Somalia, which is to the south. And yet it has one of the longest coastlines in Africa, plenty of stocks of high-value fish like tuna and lobster and shrimp and kingfish. And fish has not even been a part of the cuisine. So this was a very long, multi-year, multi-pronged effort that involved first educating communities in Somaliland that fish was not, as they had seen it, strictly a food for poor people and strictly a smelly food.
So I understand that, you know, this has employed a lot of men. What about women? I know they run cooking classes, but has this whole so-called blue economy assisted with women and women-owned businesses?
This blue economy has helped a lot of women become entrepreneurs. There are a lot of women not just running cooking classes, but selling fish at local markets. The Danish NGO that was set up to help train people and educate people, not just in how to sell fish, but how to fillet fish and how to cook fish. This is an organization called Fair Fishing. They employ women, and they've got women who are selling fish in local fish markets that they've helped establish that are near these ports. And women are also running their own fish restaurants now. And some of them have even saved enough money to buy their own boat and are employing men to fish for them. And then they wholesale that fish.
That's amazing. So maybe they'll even create a model for other African countries that are dealing with their own issues regarding climate change.
Well, that's the hope. The hope is that they can have a sustainable economy and food supply that's more 50-50. And they talk about how they went from being a red meat society to a white meat society, meaning the fish. And people are becoming a lot more health conscious and aware of the health benefits of fish. So it's having a multi-layered positive impact on Somaliland culture, society, and its economy.
All right. Well, we appreciate your giving us some insight into this. That is reporter Amy Gutman, who just returned from Somaliland, where she learned about a nomadic culture suffering from the impacts of climate change and drought and reinvented itself.
She just wants to be beautiful. She goes.
An up-and-coming young artist's song, the third single from her debut album, is offering women a message of empowerment. In a recent interview with a top 40 radio station, Alessia Cara explained the message behind her single, Scars to Your Beautiful. She said the song from her debut album, Know It All, is about body image, and it's directed at women, but some men might relate too. She said it's all about the things women go through every day in order to feel like they can love themselves or be loved. She talks about how some of them lead to women believing they're not good enough or not beautiful enough if they don't look a certain way. The song stresses that women shouldn't change how they look in order to be validated, but rather change their perspective on their perfectly perfect imperfections. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Nick Ivanhoff. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. She says beauty is pain and there's beauty in everything. What's a little bit longer? I can go a little while longer. She fades away. She don't see. She don't understand. She's worth it. All that beauty goes deeper than the surface. Oh, oh. So to all the girls that's hurting, let me be your mirror. Help you see a little bit clearer. The light that shines within. There's a hope that's waiting for you in the dark. You should know you're beautiful just the way you are. And you don't have to change a thing. The world could change.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On September 1st, Hurricane Dorian slammed into the northern Bahamas. Dorian, which carried sustained winds of 300 kilometers per hour, was the strongest storm in recorded history to hit these islands. While most of the Bahamas was spared, the damage Dorian caused to the islands of Abaco and Grand Bahama was significant. At the request and under the leadership of Prime Minister Minnis of the Bahamas, the United States mobilized immediately. Once the hurricane passed, U.S. Chargé d'Affaires Stephanie Bowers and Vice Admiral Scott Bushman of the U.S. Coast Guard accompanied Prime Minister Minnis on the first overflights of the affected islands. After the flight, U.S. Chargé d'Affaires Bowers said, "We are proud to stand hand in hand with our Bahamian friends and partners. We have one collective goal, to assist the victims of one of the strongest hurricanes ever recorded. Now is the time to come together and show what partnership means." Agencies throughout the U.S. government responded immediately. The U.S. Coast Guard began search and rescue operations even as the remnants of the storm continued to batter the islands, saving hundreds of lives. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, pre-positioned personnel and supplies in Miami, Houston, Barbados, Haiti, and Dominica, and brought them to the Bahamas the moment the storm let up. As the storm was coming in, we had pre-positioned staff, and within 24 hours of Dorian striking the Bahamas, we activated and deployed a disaster assistance response team, an elite team of disaster response experts, to assess damage, to identify humanitarian needs, and to help bring urgently needed assistance to those who were affected and continue to be affected by this terrible hurricane, said USAID Administrator Mark Green. In coordination with local authorities, humanitarian organizations, the U.S. Coast Guard, the U.S. military, the U.S. Embassy in the Bahamas, and the 101-member Disaster Assistance Response Team brought its expertise to the effort. After the initial assessments, shipments of crucial aid supplies began to arrive in the hardest-hit areas. This included food, water buckets, hygiene kits, chainsaw kits, and plastic sheeting for emergency shelters. Thus far, USAID has dedicated $2.8 million in funding for humanitarian assistance to the people in the Bahamas affected by Hurricane Dorian. USAID's teams covered some 2,010 square kilometers of land, air, and sea with search and rescue operations and assessed bridges and other infrastructure. USAID Administrator Green said, "Clearly, there is a long and difficult journey ahead, but to make it very clear, the United States is proud to stand with our neighbors and will continue to stand with our neighbors and friends in the Bahamas as we respond to and help them rebuild from this terrible storm."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. AP correspondent.